I was trying to make a joke. Nobody was following me. I'm supposed to be the spiritual speaker, I guess, Sunday morning. I don't know. I was trying to figure that one out, how I got picked to do that. But I love you, too.
Lots and lots and lots.
It's good to be here. I want to thank the committee for asking me to be here today. I'm truly honored to be here speaking to all of you, and to be asked to go anywhere and do anything at any time is just it's a blessing for me. I never had anybody asking me to go anywhere or come back anywhere, before I got here. It's been an emotional weekend for me. I was sharing with some people. I'm up here shaking a little bit. I ruptured my bicep tendon last week, and I had surgery on Tuesday. And so it's all wrapped out. You might have saw me with the sling walking in earlier, and I was thinking it's Halloween, and I got the sling. I was gonna go get a white suit with a black shirt and come in with a little machine gun, and tell you guys, you need people like me, Because I thought I was like Tony Montana when I got here, And the truth was, probably show you my age, I was like Otis, the town drunk, But I wanted to be Tony Montana. I never was, And I'm so grateful to be here. I dug listening to Eric last night. He's a good friend of mine, and I don't think he's here this morning, but you can tell him, pass it on if you see him. I thought about him last night, and I've chosen him. I'm Native American, and we sometimes we give people names, and Eric henceforth will be known as Pure Water. So that was a joke too. You guys gonna make me work for it today, huh? You think about when I'm asked to speak, I think about, sometimes the things in the past that got me here, and how I ended up here at where I'm at today. My sobriety date is March 7th of 1987. That's 26 years. I got here originally to Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 18. I'm not like the people I hear that say that they knew they were home when they got here. When I got here, I saw a bunch of gray heads, and I knew that they were different than me, and that I really didn't need to stick around. And I'll talk a little more about that. And I'm from Winslow, and a lot of people ask where Winslow is. So, like, if this is the state of Arizona, like, this is Winslow, right? Don't tell them I said that, because they're not here. My family, my mother and father, I was born to two alcoholic parents. And they were living in San Francisco when my mother was pregnant with me. And I'm Navajo, Lakota, and Mexican. And my family's from Pine Ridge, South Dakota. And if you're not familiar with Pine Ridge and who that tribe is, we were the last ones that fought in the 70s. We were the ones that occupied Wounded Knee. Those were some of my relatives. So I guess you could say we're kind of rebellious. And my father was little bit of a protester in that time, and he had been doing some things in San Francisco, and they decided that they needed to get out of San Francisco. And he's half Navajo, and his father lived in Loup. It's out on the Navajo Reservation, just north of Winslow. And so on the run, he took us up there, and the whole family, and I was the youngest of seven kids, and I wasn't born yet, and I was born there, and my father was the type of guy that would go out for a pack of smokes, and I'd meet him 22 years later. That's the kind of alcoholic he was. And so he split, and my mother kind of, I guess at that time the story goes that she decided if she couldn't beat him, she'd join him. And my take on that is that she had joined him long before she ever thought she couldn't beat him. And she started doing her thing and drinking and leaving us there alone. And out on the reservation, it's pretty tough. There's not a 7-Eleven on every corner. So if the kids get hungry, they're hungry. And CPS doesn't take too kindly to those type of things, and they came in and they took us out of the home. And I was placed in this home in Winslow. And, you know, the story that I heard about that was that from my mother, my adoptive mother, was that this white government car pulled up, and this lady gets out of this car and has this little chubby brown kid. And he's got the biggest cheeks and the biggest smile, and she looked in my green eyes, and we fell in love. And she loved me like her child, and I loved her. She's my mama today, you know, and she treated me like, my nickname, from her was El Rey, which means the king. And that's the way she treated me in my house. She treated me like the king. I never wanted for anything. I never wanted for love. I can't say that I came from an alcoholic home, because I actually wasn't raised in the alcoholic home I was born into. I was born into a really conservative Christian family. I mean, my dad was a lumberman. He worked in a lumber mill, and the guy went to work every day. He didn't ask any questions. He got up and put his shoes on, and he went to work. And that's, you know, he did what he said he was going to do, and he was a man of his word, and he was a quiet guy, and you know, he was my hero. You know, I looked up to him, and I wanted to be like him, and there was one person I knew I didn't want to be like, and that was my natural father, because I had heard things about him too. And if there was one guy in this world that I did not want to be like, it was him, you know. And I turned out just like him and some more, you know. But anyways, I was raised in that family, and I got here. I hear in Alcoholics Anonymous a lot of people say that when, you know, there was just something out there that made you feel different. Oh, by the way, my arm looks a little weird, so I know people were watching me. This ain't my old crack walk, you know, like the army stuck. But I forgot what I was saying after that. Where was I?
You felt different.
I felt different. There you go. And I heard people say that, and I knew why I felt different. You know, like I said, I'm Lakota, Navajo, Mexican. I was raised by a Southern Baptist Mexican family in a black neighborhood. And if you've never heard a Southern Baptist sermon in Spanish, you do not know the fear of God. Now, I don't know what they were saying, but I know they were damn serious about it. And every once in a while, they'd put a hand on my head and say something. And I was hoping it was working. And that's the kind of home I was raised in. And one day I was out playing with my buddy on the block. And in Winslow, there's not many places to shop. Our parents used to have to travel to Flagstaff to go shopping, you know. And so his parents went for the afternoon. And he had this brilliant idea. I wasn't raised with alcohol in the home, so we didn't have a bar, but he did. And he said, "Hey Bob, let's try something out." And he went in and got a bottle of gin. And I know it was gin because I saw the word gin. And it was a frosty bottle. It was pretty. It was just a beautiful bottle. And he took the cap off and he took a sip, and man, it looked like this just the, I mean, it looked like the most god-awful thing you could do. You know, he took a slug and just started spitting up right away, and it's coming out of his nose. He starts puking. His eyes water up. You know, he's hunched over. It just looks god awful. But I'm a man of my word. And I like to stick to my commitments. And I took a drink. And I put that bottle up to my lips, and it started to trickle down my throat, and it felt a little warm, and it hit my throat. And it proceeded to go down farther, and my chest like caught on fire. And then it hit my belly. And something happened when it hit my belly. And the only way I know how to describe it is like this. When that alcohol hit my belly, the clouds parted, the birds started singing, the grass got a little greener, he became the best buddy I ever had in life, and life was beautiful. It was like 4th of July and Christmas rolled up into one moment. And if I could capture that moment from that point on, that's what I was trying to get every time I was doing it. I was trying to recapture that first time. immediately after I had that feeling, I remembered there were some guys in that neighborhood that had been picking on me. And we straightened that up. There was also this really cute girl that lived in my neighborhood. And she didn't know how cute I thought she was. And after I took that drink, she found out. And that's kind of what alcohol did for me at one time. You know, I could go into the restroom and look in the mirror, and at that point in my life, especially going into the teenage years, you know, I would see this chubby brown kid with pimples all over his face, and I knew that my life would be right, it would be okay if one day I walked in there, and I looked in the mirror, and this guy that was 6'2 and blonde hair and blue eyes was looking back at me, and I knew my life would be wonderful if I ever experienced that. And, you know, everything in my head made me different than you. Everything in my head made me less than you. From the earliest times I can remember. And I don't know where I ever got that from, because I can't tell you that I got that from anybody. Nobody ever told me that. Like I said, I was very loved when I ended up in that home. I don't know where that came from. I'd like to believe that that's part of my alcoholism. Now, I said I tried to recapture that drink again. I never did. I never did. And I would try to figure out, years later, I'd like sit there and try to figure out the, you know, nuances. Is it the seventh drink, man, or is it the tenth? Which one is it where I cross that line and just turn into a slob? You know, because there's a point in there for like 20 seconds where I'm like actually pretty slick. But it only lasts 20 seconds. And I went chasing that. Luckily for me, I grew up in a small town, and I just happened to be good at sports, and it was always kind of a natural thing to me. I was a 2-time All-American. I was a national champion wrestler in Greco-Roman and freestyle, and two sports, and two different styles, and I played football, and I was highly recruited to play football, and I had this bright future in front of me. And I remember when I was 8 years old, I remember sitting there in front of the TV, and it was me and my mom, and Monday Night Football was on, and the Bears were playing, and I'm not a Bears fan, don't do that. I'm just kidding. So I'm watching this Bears game, and I remember looking at the TV screen and looking over to my mom and telling my mom, you know, I want to be on there someday. I want to be there. And I did. And that was my dream, and I proceeded to try to make it there. You know, and drinking got in the way. You know, it's hard to achieve goals when you can't show up for school. You know, and Winslow's small enough that, you know, if I got pulled over or something happened with the cops, they knew who I was, and instead of taking me to jail and going through that mess, they'd take me home. Because I had a game on Friday. And football in Winslow is like football in Texas. We take it pretty serious. And so I never got in trouble, and that's the only reason I didn't get in trouble at a young age. You know, I went through pretty much just doing whatever I wanted to do, you know. And my idea of you loving me, like, I'm the black hole of love, man. My idea of the way that you love me is you let me do whatever I want to. You never complain. And we just do everything my way. Whether it's wrong or right. And especially if it's wrong, don't tell me it's wrong. Just go with it. And that's my idea of love. And my parents had another idea of love. You know, they watched me struggle, and I was going down, and we were starting to have problems. And all of a sudden, those loving parents that were my heroes became my enemies. And they became people that didn't know anything about life, you know. And they just were the most ignorant people I'd ever met, you know, at that time in my life. And I was doing my thing, you know. And right before my senior year, we were out cruising around one night on 4th of July, and I'm arguing with my buddies. I want a 12-pack. They don't want to drink. They don't drink like me. We're going back and forth. I finally get them to pull into this Circle K to get this 12-pack, and as we pulled in, we almost got in a little accident, and this guy follows us into the parking lot, and to make a long story short, he gets out of the car. My buddy that I grew up with is like a brother to me, gets out of the car, and there wasn't two words said, and he pulled out a gun and shot him. And then he tried to kill me and his brother. And I was 17 years old. And, you know, I wanted to be like that dude, like I said, Tony Montana. You know, when the bullets are flying, that I come out and I stand up to him, man. That I look you in the eye and I say, go ahead, make my day. You know, that's what I want to be like when the guns come out. But that's not what I'm like when guns come out. When guns come out and bullets start flying, I run. And if you're smart, you'll run too. That's what happened. And, you know, I just went through life after that. I take a thing like that, right? This terrible tragedy that happened to this young man and his family. And only an alcoholic can take that event and make it about me. See, if I hadn't argued with them to get that beer there that night, we wouldn't have been at that Circle K. Ronnie would have never died. It's my fault. Now I have to drink myself to death. Not one moment during that time did I think about his parents or his brother who also saw him murdered. I didn't think about them. I didn't think about Ronnie and how young he was, and he was in the prime of his life and he was just getting started. I didn't think about Ronnie. I thought about me, and I proceeded to destruct my life from that point on in a hard way. And all those dreams and things that I had planned went by the wayside, and they weren't important to me anymore. You know, drinking became the number one goal of my life. That's all I wanted to do. And by the end of that year, things weren't going well. You know, I had tried to commit suicide, and I remember sitting in the hospital, and this guy came to visit me that I played ball with, and he said, Bob, man, I don't get you, man. Like, you got everything I want. You got parents that love you. You know, I got parents that are alcoholics, man. They don't show up to my games. They don't come to my school. I mean, you got the parents I always wanted. You make the grades, man. I, like, struggle, and I'm in special classes, and I can't make the grades, and you make the grades. And then you go out there, and you put the equipment on, and you play football, and it's like you never even had to learn how to play football. You just knew how to play football. And guys like me, we got to work and show up to practice and practice over and over to do what you do, and you just do it. You got everything I want, man. And you're trying to end it, and I don't get it. I just don't get it. And I looked in his face, and I wanted to give him an answer, but I didn't get it either. I didn't know what was wrong with me. I had no idea. I thought I was just crazy. And I got out of there, and I had found out where my biological mother lived. And I decided that it was Winslow. You know, if you grew up in a dive town like Winslow, like I did, and drank with dive people like I drink with, you'd end up having the dive life that I had. So I need to get out of Winslow. And I called her up. And I found out that she lived on 6th Street, right off Mesa Drive, 2 blocks away from here. I don't know what direction we're in. She's around here somewhere. And I made contact with her, and I told her, you know, it's going really bad for me here in Winslow, and I feel like, you know, if I just got down there and had a different chance, I'd turn things around. And can I come down and stay with you? And she said, yeah. And I figured she owed me that much, you know? I keep a little book. I'm like the Rain Man. You know? January 11th, 1965. You abandoned me. I took inventory long before I ever heard of a fourth step. I knew whose fault it was. And so I take the bus from Winslow, which is a 2.5-hour drive. You got to have at least 2 pints of tequila for that, right? So I get my 2 pints of tequila, I get off the bus here in Mesa, she takes one look at me, I'm expecting the moment from TLC, right? You know what I'm talking about? The reunion moments from TLC when the families see each other again? And they're at the airport, and across the airport, they run to each other, and they have balloons and flowers, and everybody's crying with joy, and everybody's hugging and jumping around together, and they're just so in love that they got to reconnect. Now that's what I expected. But I get off the bus and she steps to me, and I guess that Cuervo hit her, and she stepped back. And she goes, my car's over there. Put your bag in the back. And she got in the car. I thought, that's kind of rude. She doesn't say a word, you know. We get to her house and she shows me the room I'm staying in, and she takes me in there and she says, that's where you're sleeping. I'll see you in the morning. She goes to bed. Now, wait, I'm talking talking 18 years, I haven't seen this lady. I mean, she owes me at least $100, I figure. I mean, something. You know, here's a Christmas for something, right? That's what I'm expecting. And that doesn't happen. She goes to bed. I'm a little ticked off. So I proceed that night to look for whatever kind of alcohol or cough syrup or whatever they had. And they had nothing in this house. Nothing. And every room I went into, they had these two prayers. One said something about footprints and the other one said something about serenity. And they seemed like real simple prayers. But they had these two prayers on plaques in every room in the house. I mean, they had it in the laundry room. They had it above the toilet. They had it above the kitchen sink. Right? I mean, everywhere you go, these two prayers are. And I'm thinking, these are simple prayers. You can memorize this. I think I got it. I mean, I'm not going to forget this prayer from the living room to the bedroom, right? So I don't need them everywhere. I got it. I'm thinking, this is strange. Then I wake up in the morning, my stepfather comes in and he says, hey, you want to go out to lunch today? I said, yeah. He says, all right, get ready, we'll head out. So I get ready. We get in the car, we start driving, and he goes, oh, hey, you don't mind if I stop somewhere, do you, before we go eat? I said, nah. He said, it'll only take about an hour. I go, cool. Do what you got to do, right? So we pull into this parking lot, and it's a church. And I'm going, uh-oh. Somebody notified him. Now some people are going to come out, and I'm the prayer group, right? They're going to pray over me. So I am not stepping foot in there. And he gets out, and I say, I'll wait out here for you, man. I'll smoke some smokes, and I'll wait out here for you in the parking lot. No, no, come on in. I got some friends I want you to meet. Like, this guy's 70 years old. I don't want to meet your friends. And it was the most surreal thing. I walk into this room, and there's all these old guys in there. And I don't know about you, but when I was using, man, there was a certain type of person I didn't like. You know? They dress kind of like I'm dressed today. And they look clean. And they have minty fresh breath. So you can smell it when you see all their teeth and they smile. To let you know how good their life is. That kind of guy? I hate that kind of guy. I just want to pop one of those guys in the nose back then, you know? What's there to be so happy about? But this room was full of happy guys. And they're all happy. And they're like super excited to meet me. I can't figure out why they're so excited to meet me. Everybody's shaking my hand and introducing them. I don't want to know you. Like, I'm just here to, whatever he's doing, I'm just here. I'm along for the ride. I don't want to get to know you. And they start shaking my hands. And then the thing starts, and they have this table like this. There's like two people sitting here like this. And there's a blue book up there. And they begin to read the preamble of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he sat all the way on the other room, my stepfather. Out of reach. Because I was pissed. And I proceeded to listen to this AA meeting. And it was like, I mean, I could not believe this thing, right? They talk about, I mean, wrecking cars, losing families. They talk about some disgusting things and then everybody laughs. They share indictable things in that meeting. You know, you don't make those kind of things a matter of public record. Keep that to yourself. And they laugh. And I thought, this is the weirdest thing. And I just want to get out of here. Because I'm not like them. I'm not like them. And the clock just ticked. Just kind of like maybe some of you are sitting here feeling right now. But anyways, the clock's just ticking. And I want out of there. And I'm almost there. I'm almost at the door. You know, and I like John Madden when he used to do the telestrator and show football plays and stuff. See, here's what I think happened. I think that all those old dudes got together the night before. And they got this chalkboard up there and they said, okay, we're going to sit him right here. There's two exits. If he heads towards either one of you, fake a heart attack. Drip him with your cane. Do whatever you got to do. But do not let him out of that room. And they wouldn't let me out of this room. And I was almost out of this room. Almost out of this room. I mean, I could smell sunshine. And I'm about to reach for the door, and this, the happiest guy of the happy guys wants to talk to me. You know the happy guy of the happy guys? He's always got like 10 little guys following behind him everywhere he goes. And when he talks, people just go, wow. You know what I mean? You know the happy guy. And the last happy guy comes to talk to me. And he starts telling me, man, I'm not saying that you're an alcoholic, but if you are an alcoholic and you continue to drink, son, some of these things are going to happen to you. Those jails and those institutions you heard about, you're going to hit those places. Those loss of family, that's going to happen to you. And in the end, you're going to die an alcoholic death. But I'm not saying you're an alcoholic. If you are an alcoholic and you continue to drink. Now, I know in my mind you're saying, I'm an alcoholic. You're just using code word for it. I happen to not agree with you, which is my choice. I think it's covered in the First Amendment. I don't know. But I walk out of there and I'm thinking, thank you for the information. If I ever get as old and as burned out as some of you guys in your 30s and 40s, I'll come back. But I'm not. I'm doing my thing. I'm 18. I'm doing what 18-year-olds do. And I went out and I proceeded to do my thing. 6 months later, I'm in the Winslow City Jail. I'm reading that I am being sent to an institution. And I was also served my divorce papers. And I thought about that happy guy. I thought, that guy, man, he spoke this into my life, right? If he would have never said it, never would have happened. He had to go project this stuff, his stuff onto me, and his energy came onto me, and that's why I'm sitting here in jail, because of that happy guy. And if I ever see that happy guy again. So they sent me to this institution, and I began my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous at that time. And I'm down here, and I'm running around, and like I said, it's been an emotional weekend for me, y'all. I was involved in a high-speed chase. I, again, say don't know which direction I'm in right now. But on Maine, I was involved in a high-speed chase right there. Before they recorded them, it was cool, right? And Country Club takes you straight to Winslow. If you get on Country Club and just head north, it takes you to Winslow. If you're ever looking for a getaway. We'll take you to meetings. Come on up. Because once you get up there, there's nowhere else to go. And so I made my getaway, you know. A little further down the street, there's a Denny's. And it was a Sunday morning one morning. And I was running these streets, man. And I remember I had lost my shoes. I don't know if anybody else ever lost their shoes, but I lost my shoes quite a bit. Yeah, cool. You know, I'm not the only one, right? But I used to lose my shoes. And it was summer. And it was getting to about noontime, a little hot. And I'm going down Maine, and I'm just trying, I live on Dobson University. And I don't even remember where I was at, but I know I'm running down Maine, and I'm looking for grass. You know what I mean? There's like little patches of grass. You don't see them as much if you're not looking for it. But if you look for them, there's a lot of them. So I'm running to the grass. I cool off my feet. I just happened to pop into this Denny's right down the street in front of it. And I looked in, and there was this dude dressed like me. And he was walking in with this beautiful lady and two little kids. And I knew where they were coming from. I used to go there on Sunday morning with my family. I knew what it was about. And they looked happy. And I remember sitting in that window and looking in there. And I remember just this empty feeling in my gut and knowing deep down inside. And I was mad at God. And I told God, how come I'm always going to be out here looking in? I will never be the guy in there doing that life and having that life. I'm always going to be the guy out here looking in. And I was angry that day about being an alcoholic. And I think that almost on that day that I might have had a little bit of that convincing of the innermost self that I was a true alcoholic. I knew I wasn't beating it that day. I knew where I was at. And I continued to drink. And on March 7th of 87, I woke up that morning. And I thought about that happy guy. And he had said, if you're a real alcoholic and you want to try to quit drinking, You might try getting on your knees and asking God to relieve you of the obsession of alcohol. Now, let me point out where I was at that time in my life. I got down to say that prayer. Number one, I didn't know what an obsession of alcohol was. See, I had been around Alcoholics Anonymous for 4 years and had no idea what a mental obsession was and a physical allergy. None. I think that's a key part to staying sober. To know that. See, because what happened was, is I was trying to fix problems, didn't know what the problem was, so therefore, how can I find a solution? If the problem is probation, all I gotta do is get off probation. If the problem is her, I just gotta get rid of her. If the problem is the job, I just don't have to show up on Monday, see? And I kept having all these issues, and I kept trying to fix all these problems. And I never knew I had a physical allergy and a mental obsession. I never knew that. And I said that prayer that morning, and I got up, and I haven't had a drink since that day. And I got back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And, man, it has been beautiful seeing all you young people. I used to hate this. Because when I came in, there wasn't a lot of young people in the meetings that I was at. Okay? And there'd always be like some like sweet little old lady, right? That you gotta be respectful to. You know? And she'd come up and she'd give me one of these. It's so good to see you young people in here. I'm so glad you've been spared the years of tragedy and pain that us older people have been spared. I wanted the tripper, man. I'm like, does this say winner? Like, it's orange. Does it look like I'm winning at anything? Does it look like I've been spared anything? What the hell are you talking about? I didn't drink in my robe and hide my bottle of gin in the hamper, lady. Carjack people like you. So don't tell me what I've been spared. So that being said, it's so good to see so many young people here this morning that could potentially be spared all that pain and misery that comes along with drinking into your upper ages. Because believe me, it's a lot better getting sober young. It is. It's a kick, man. Every day of my life is just a dream come true. I never dreamed that I'd be sitting up at this podium, that I'd be the guy here on Sunday morning to talk to you about staying sober. I never thought that I'd have a beautiful wife and 6 beautiful children that I love very much, and she takes care of me, man. She's like everything I ever wanted. And I found her when I wasn't looking for her. Instead of trying to find the right girl, I started trying to become the right man. And she came along. And she saved my life. In sobriety. We've been together 10 years now, and we just celebrated 7 years anniversary last month. And I bring them up because, you know, I want to let you know that they share me with all of you quite a bit. You know, it takes a lot to let your husband go out and in the middle of the night at 2 o'clock and trust when he says, I'm going to go pick up a new guy. Whoa. Okay. I'm watching my time. I'm trying. So, you know, it takes a lot to do that. And especially this sobriety thing, man. You know, we come in here. I know there's a lot of young people here today, and I came in and I didn't really, you know, I came in young at 22, and I never knew what turn life was gonna take. You know, I thought that I come in here and I get sober and I work the steps and I stay active and my life is just beautiful from here on out and everything just runs perfectly. And I get all the things that I want and everybody stays alive and we all get to get out of this thing happy. And that's what I thought. And on May 4th of 2011, My eldest son, Brandon, had been coming around these rooms, and he had put together about 90 days, and I heard he had been coming around these rooms. You know, I had some people telling me, and he had been in and out of this thing, and he was 2 weeks away from turning 27, and on May 4th, 2011, he hung himself and he took his life. And I got that call that parents dread. And at that moment, I just remember kind of going to my knees and this immense pain hitting my heart that I thought would kill me, actually literally kill me. It hurt so bad. And as I was on the floor, my wife came in rushing in the door, and there was two alcoholics who were already at my house at the front door waiting to come in, and they came in and they picked me up and they put their arms around me, and for the next 2 weeks they loved me like I've never been loved before. You know, later that afternoon my house was full of alcoholics, sober alcoholics. Every room we went into there was sober alcoholics gathered. And the guys I got sober with were there. You know, they came from wherever they lived, and they showed up by that afternoon. And they were there. And in Winslow, we're not fortunate enough to have meetings, you know, at 12 and 8 and different times. I mean, we only have, you know, a couple meetings a day sometimes, and sometimes one. And it was 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and the next meeting was at 8. And here I am, you know, 24 years sober, and it's 3 o'clock, and I remember looking at my boys and saying, man, get the cars and get me to Flagstaff, because there's a meeting at 6. And I don't think I can make it till 8. Not that I felt like I was going to drink. I just wanted to be in these rooms. And I just wanted to be among you. Because I knew in my life that this is my safe place. This is where I can go. When all else fails, man, if I come here, I'm going to be okay. If I can make it here. It's kind of like kick the can, you know? And I made it there, and we're sitting there, and the meeting starts, you know, and they ask a thing about the newcomers, and they ask if there's any newcomers, and this kid stands up, this native kid. He had to be native, right? And he says, my name's Brandon, and I'm 24 hours sober. And I thought about my Brandon, and I thought about the part in the book where it talks about the supreme sacrifice that some make so that those of us who are here today can be here. And I realized that my son had made the supreme sacrifice. And then maybe Brandon was there because of that. I don't know. But I had a sense of things are going to be okay, Bob. We're going to go through a little rough patch here, and it's going to get real rough. But it's going to be okay, and we're going to get through this. And you know, like I said, there was people there. But at the end of that, at that time after the funeral, and there's a tough part when everybody goes home, you know, and then a few weeks later, people stop calling as much. And they stop coming by as much. And a lot of people don't know that that's your loneliest time. That's when you're hurting the worst, is when everybody's gone. And this guy I sponsored named Claim, he came, and I was sitting out on my deck in my backyard. That's my meditation place. And I was just sitting out there praying, and he comes in, he sits next to me, and he says, man, I don't know what to say. I don't know what to do. I don't know what I'm here for. I don't know, Bob. But I'm here, and I'm not going until you tell me to go. Until you tell me to leave. I'm not leaving. And I don't know if you need me to pray with you. I don't know if you need me to hold your hand. I don't know what you need me to do, but you just tell me what you need me to do. But I'm here, man, until you tell me to go. And he stayed there with me for 10 days on that chair and going to meetings with me. And I was like, some nights I was just like, go home. And I didn't have that before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I didn't have that. And I got to speak on a panel at IckyPod. My next eldest son is now sober 60 days in this program. And I got to enjoy that. You know, I think of Brandon. I was thinking of him this morning. I was thinking of him last night as all of you were having fun. You know, we throw this word around sometimes around this program of suicide like it's just this thing. Like we like to say when we have hard times that, you know, we like to throw that word out. I know I have. I know I've been over dramatic at times and I threw that word out without knowing what the intention of and what that was going to do to the rest of the lives that I was going to affect if I ever did that. Brandon didn't know the hell I was going to go through after he left. He didn't know what his mom was going to go through. You know, he had no idea how much he was loved. You know, here's this little, right, this thug gangster in our town. He was connected and, you know, there was police presence at the funeral and, but it was one of the biggest funerals Winslow's ever had. And I know he didn't know that. I know he never would have thought that he'd have one of the biggest funerals that Winslow has ever had. I know that he didn't think that. I know he didn't know that how many people cared about him and loved him and how special he was to so many people. That his smile would be missed. That his beauty would be missed. I get to see it in his 5-year-old son. Today I see him. I see his face and I see the wonderment and I see who Brandon used to be before alcohol and drugs took that all away from him and left him a shell. And I got through these last 2 years. I'm going to tell you how. I came down here. Somebody asked me to speak at some meeting down here and I came down here. And I met Eric and I met some other young people. And I started to get invited to speak more and more at these different places. I kept meeting some of more of you young people. And the Flagstaff young people I love, I see them all the time. Yeah. And we get to see each other quite a bit. And you young people, I gotta tell you young people have lit a fire under this old fart. I don't like hanging out with them anymore. Don't tell them, okay? Keep it secret. I love hanging out with you guys. I love, you know, as you walk into the room of Alcoholics Anonymous, before I got here this morning and I was out there and walking around and you can hear this noise and I call it the Symphony of Alcoholics Anonymous because it's the most beautiful music my ears have ever heard because it goes straight from my ears to my soul. It's that chatter that goes on in the meeting rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. That laughter. And I heard that as I was coming down here. And that attracted me. I wanted that. And man, God has taken me on such a ride. It's been so unbelievable for me to be here today, sober, to go through some of the things that I've gone through in sobriety and not pick up. Not pick up. And you know, I lost my sponsor a couple months ago, and he was 49 years sober. And yeah, how do you argue with a guy that was 12-step by Chuck C? Like, it's kind of tough, but I tried. And who's got, you know, letters written from Bill? And he told me this story about the day his sponsor was buried. And it was a touching story, and I thought of him the day he was buried. He told me that, you know, they went down, they went to the funeral, and then they went to bury him at the cemetery. And they got there, and my sponsor was just kind of no-nonsense kind of guy. Tough old guy, you know. Fireman. And they get there, and he's I wouldn't call him the most sensitive guy in the world. But they get there to the burial and they're done with the ceremony of the burial and they get up to leave and his wife gets up to leave and he stays sitting in the chair and he says, "I'm not leaving yet." And she's like, "Wow, I've never seen a man like this." She says, "Okay, honey." She says, "I'll sit here with you and wait." So she sits down with him and they start putting the dirt on and they put the dirt on and she says, "Are you ready to go now, Phil?" And he says, "No, well, I'm not ready to go yet. I'll tell you when I'm ready to go. I'm not ready to go." So they start putting more dirt on. They finally start packing it down. And they get it all packed down. And Phil gets up and he goes, "Okay, let's go." She says, "Okay, honey." She starts walking back to the car with him. And she goes, "Phil, can I ask you something?" I says, "Sure." "Why did we have to stay there for that whole thing?" And she's expecting this, like, spiritual, you know what I mean? And he says, "Because my secrets are down there and I want to make sure the dirt gets on top and they never get out." It's kind of hard to be sad at the guy's funeral when you think of that story. Because he took my secrets with him. He took my secrets with him, and I got to go share with him after my son passed. And, you know, he had told me something early on. He said, "Bob, I can't promise you that all the times are going to be good. I can't promise you that all the times are going to be bad. I can't promise you that there's going to come a time and day when the only thing that stands between you and a drink is a connection to that higher power, whatever power you have. And that's it. There might not be a sponsor. There might not be a big book. There might not be a meeting. Some people might not be answering their phone that day. I don't know. But that time is going to come when it's just you and God. And I hope you've made your peace." And he took me through the steps in 3 weeks. Amends everything early on, you know, and he saved my life. And I thought about talking more about the steps with some of, you know, in here, and I like to talk about recovery. Don't get me wrong. I'm all for the steps. My home group is the men's thumpers, men's stag meeting of Winslow. So that kind of tells you where my head's at in the book. And, you know, I believe what's in there. I believe what's in there. And Phil used to tell me, you know, "Bob, you can eat that book. If you don't do what's inside of it, it's not working." See, I can get up here in this nice suit, and I've done this a few times now, so I can handle myself pretty well up here. But when we really find out what kind of a program Bob has, and whether Alcoholics Anonymous has made a change in my life, when you really want to see that is when I get in the car with my family to drive home. How I treat my beautiful wife, how I treat my beautiful kids. That's when you really find out what I'm about. And this is all good and fun. I love doing this. Don't get me wrong. I love doing this. I love to see all your smiling faces. But man, you know where my spot is? Man, put me in the car with the new guy for a drive that he doesn't know he's going on. He thinks he's going to a meeting across town. We're going to Prescott. And we're going to share some things. Last Friday, I spoke in Cottonwood. And there was a guy named Rob, and he was sitting in the front row, right over here to my right. And I kept looking at him. He was 24 hours. And the thing about Rob was is that I had spoken in Cottonwood several times, and every time I showed up to speak at Cottonwood, Rob was getting a 24-hour chip. And as we were driving down, making the drive down Friday, we got past Cortis Junction, and there was like 7-8 highway patrol cars, and they had the, you know, when they do survey and they have the scope and stuff and they're looking for distance and all of that, and there's cop cars and they're looking off in the distance, and my phone picks up right as we pass there, and it's a guy, a sponsor named JD, who was Rob's sponsor. And he says, "You never believe what happened, man. Rob flew off the 17 going 150 on his bike, drunk. And that was Rob's scene." Now, you know, why would I get up on a Sunday morning, drive from Winslow up here, make the drive back? People always ask me, "How do you just make the drive up to Phoenix anytime you're asked to speak? Are you serious?" You know, as Clayton was leaving that day, he asked me, he said something. He says, "I hate to bring this up, but you were booked to speak at my meeting. And I know this is a bad time for you, and if you got to cancel, man, and you can't do it, I understand." I said, "Well, hold on, man." I said, let me pray about this, man." And so I went to go on my spot, and I went to go say that prayer. And, you know, 30 seconds into the prayer, I'm like, "Really? Really? This is the prayer, right? God, do you want me to go help another human being?" I mean, they could be dying from a fatally terminal chronic illness. Should I go help them? I mean, can I get off week? A bye week? You know? I mean, really? So I go to that meeting and I speak. His brother shows up. His son is named Brandon. His oldest son is named Brandon. He shows up at the meeting, has never heard me speak. 2 weeks later, his Brandon kills himself the same way my Brandon did. First meeting. I'm speaking. We became good buddies after that. We talked daily, weekly after that. You know, here today, I mean, God has just taken me on these wild trips, and I'm so grateful to be here, and I'm trying to get, I gotta wind down here, but somebody asked me, you know, earlier we were talking, somebody asked me, you know, Bob, what's different about AA today than it was when you came in? You know, is it changed? And I believe it has in some ways. Now, I want to make this clear. I believe that the core principles and the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous and the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, you can't change them. They're principles. They're laws. They're spiritual laws. I'm not capable of changing those things. What is always will be in Alcoholics Anonymous. What's changed is I see more young faces in here, and I see more acceptance about some different things, and more tolerance. And like I said, you know, I got tired of hanging out with those old farts I hang out, because we get kind of grumpy sometimes. You know? And I started hanging with the young people, and Alcoholics Anonymous has just opened this whole new world to me again. And I never thought, I mean, 20-something years, I never thought that would happen, that I could start new in Alcoholics Anonymous again. And I have. And I have the biggest commitment at my home group. It's the biggest, most important commitment at my home group. I am the most important guy at that home group. I am the coffee maker. Thank you, thank you. And I just want to share this with you and shut up and get off of here, but when I hit the 20-year mark, you know, they didn't go, "Hey, Bob, come here. Hey, we're going to let you in now. We got these meetings that they don't know about." And we all go there. And we listen to each other's speaker tapes. And after we hear them, we clap real loud and pat each other on the back. And we trade off. And we got a different book. There's not a lot of action required. It's kind of like Reader's Digest. It just hits the highlights. You can put it on the toilet. It won't take too much of your time. And those new guys, there's plenty of people to handle them. You don't need to do that anymore. You don't got to pick up that dude that is got alcohol on his breath, hasn't taken a shower in 3 days, put him in your wife's nice new car, and that smell's going to be there for a week. You don't have to do that anymore, Bob. And by the way, we think you've kind of overdone it on meetings over the years. You really don't have to go to two some days. I think we can let you get by with one a week. Nobody has taken me into the separate room in Alcoholics Anonymous and told me that. That day that I sat with my sponsor, I opened the same book that you opened up. If you opened your book. And I've worked the same steps that you have worked, if you've worked the steps. And I've had the same experiences that hopefully, you know, that some of you will have. It's hard to explain what 26 years like is when, you know, I couldn't fathom that. But you show me a guy when I got here with 2 days. Are you kidding me? You got 2 days, dude? How did you get 2 days? I want to know how you got to, because the guy with 26 is full of it, right? Like he snuck one in on St. Patty's Day somewhere. But the guy with 2 days, man, he's got the answer. And I want that answer. And Alcoholics Anonymous works in all areas of my life. It does. It's my solution and it's my way of living today. And on those days when I go through things, like when I lost my son, my sister's buried just a little ways away, and she died from this disease too. On those days when it's cloudy and it's gloomy and it seems like, I don't know, I'm just alone, I come to the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and I sit in here and I hear the laughter as I'm coming in. and we say the prayer. And through the meeting, I start to see some smiling faces, and some of us connect. And I know that it's the language of the heart. And somewhere along the line, I've touched your heart, and you've touched mine. And I walk out of that room, and the clouds part, and the birds start singing. I think the grass gets a little greener. And I found everything that I was ever looking for with all of you. And I want to thank you for my life. Thank you very much.